There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
And Ros Marshall is with us here in studio. She's CEO at Taaleem. It is wonderful to have you back here with us this morning. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Nice to be here again.
How's it been? How's back to school, back to work been over the last couple of weeks?
Well, we're very glad we've had a four-day week last week. I think just the sort of sheer effort of getting over the hurdle of the first few days of term with getting all the students back in to classrooms and everybody settled, all the new students and everything. So we're beginning to feel now in week three that things are sort of starting to settle and get into their slipstream now.
It just seems like, I mean, there's been a lot of stories doing the rounds education-wise in the last couple of weeks, with good reason. There's always that drive of back-to-school stories. And then once the school, the academic year starts, then we see a number of stories coming out of schools. And it's interesting this year that, that there certainly seems to be a lot more competition out there from somebody just observing the press releases we're getting, the stories we're getting out there. So I suppose that makes the education sector that more competitive from an operator's point of view.
Certainly in Dubai, there's the largest number of international schools through an English medium here in the Emirate and then around anywhere else in the world. In fact, the UAE has the highest number of international schools in the world, yeah, more than China. So, and the competition with 13 new schools opening this year here in Dubai has ramped it up yet again. I've been here for 5 years now, and each year there's been a whole host of new schools opening every September, and we've seen the impact this year of schools taking a very different tack on marketing with different discounts, founders discounts, to lure in a cohort of students to make a school viable, because these new schools last year were opening up typically with fewer than 100 students, and that makes it very, very difficult, not just commercially, which people always turn to and think, oh, it's because they can't make a profit, but it's actually makes it very difficult to make the classes viable and the interaction for the students to establish a school with such small numbers.
See, that's a really interesting point that you make there, and something I was discussing over the weekend, which is this idea that gone are the days, you know, we've been talking about the crash of 2008 and the fair weather packages you had before that, the hardship posting packages that used to exist before then. Times have changed fundamentally. A number of industries have changed here. But I suppose one that is really going through change at the moment is the education sector, because gone are the days when schools had waiting lists. Not all schools, and some schools still do. But is it fair to say that schools now have to be a little more creative with regards to syllabus and activities that they offer and what they're offering prospective students in order to attract them against the competition?
I think it's true that schools have certainly matured. I mean, the company that I work for is Taaleem, and we've been around for 13 years. And just looking at the evolution of our existing schools that have been around from the start to where they are now, they've all matured and they've all become something very different in terms of serving their local communities. And it takes time to establish that community. And of course, as we know, with Dubai, with the shifting sands and different communities growing all around the areas of Dubai, those communities take time to establish too. So everybody's playing a sort of second-hand guessing game, really, about what does the community need? What are the sort of people who are going to live here? What sort of expenses will they have, and what will they be looking for in terms of their children's destinations for university and so on. So you're always trying to anticipate the future. And within our group and our portfolio of schools, we have 9 here in Dubai, and you're looking at how do you actually shape each of those schools to serve each of those communities, because they are very different.
Listen, we'd welcome any comments with regards to the education sector. Feel free to send them in to us on 4001. Obviously, it is and has been a topic of conversation throughout the last couple of weeks, and will remain to be so throughout the entire academic year. The four-day working week. Interesting time to be having this conversation, Ros, because we've just had a four-day working week last week.
Indeed, and that's why I picked it out, because it is one of those things which I don't think is a unilateral opportunity for every industry, schools being one of them. But I think it is something that's mindful in terms of more flexible working. And just as you were saying about the economy and how that's matured and changed over the years, and people's packages, remuneration is a reflection of that. So it is, I think, in terms of the flexible working week. And that's something that hasn't really been established across the piece here in Dubai or in the UAE. But certainly picking up on what trade unions were saying in the UK last week about technological advances, especially in artificial intelligence, you know, could that create a four-day working week? And obviously, after last week with the Islamic New Year and the public holiday on Thursday, it does feel very much like an appealing proposition. But the research for a shorter working week is also on their side, really. The company in New Zealand, for example, that allowed its employees to work for 4 days but pay them for five to see it how it affected their business, showed a marked reduction in the stress of their staff and an improved work-life balance, which is elusive to many of us, but also no loss of productivity. And so the company has planned there to make a complete switch and a change. But then conversely, in America, where they felt that they wanted to have a trial there, that didn't work. There was the governor of the U.S. state of Utah back in 2008 introduced a four-day week for public employees and asked them to work 10 hours a day from Monday to Thursday. But 2 years later, that plan fell apart because it hadn't delivered any of the promised operational savings. So I think it is really sort of horses for courses, something that, you know, flexible working days, working in shifts, and even working from home to ensure that someone is available around the clock, this 24/7 mentality that industry is looking for now across the globe as industry becomes a global business, could be something that is more of a solution there for motivating staff and knowing how you can give people more flexibility. Not
in conversation with Ros Marshall here in studio. Just want to stick with the four-day week debate, because that is one that is prompting a number of people to text in. Have you ever worked a four-day week? Is there an example of where it's worked in the past in other countries? How can you compare and contrast? Is it something that your company is looking to do? Because I suppose it's this mindset, isn't it? Playing the devil's advocate on this one, Ros, I suppose one of the things is, one of the big concerns we have at the moment is presenteeism and being shown to be at your desk or to be seen at your desk or to be seen to be actively involved is what your bosses want to see, and therefore you're going to keep your job a little longer. One of the reasons that the TUC back in the UK mooted this four-day week idea is because of technology, artificial intelligence, and the way that so much of our jobs are now being done more efficiently. Therefore, do we need to be there all the time? I suppose that the cynic in me is thinking, oh, hang on, that one day a week from the one day away from the office each week, how many is that going to become down the line as and when technology gets that much more efficient in time?
Well, it depends on the job you do, I think. And, you know, certainly there are some companies where they have a much more sort of higher level of technology involvement, which could then be replaced by AI into the future. But we basically have to be ready to change, I think. And we'd be dismayed if all employers were counting heads at desks and watching hours on the clock the whole time. You know, most of us in this modern world now are looking at outputs and looking at key performance indicators based on output measures rather than input measures of how many hours have you sat at your desk for. It's your productivity of what you're actually achieving. And some people are built quite differently and are much more creative and much more focused if they're out of the office, working from home even, and can still give you much better output if you're not actually just stuck to your desk the whole time. So it depends on the industry and depends what you're doing. But I think in general, it needs a bit of common sense and balance to it. I mean, there are companies here who are trialling it, which sounds quite sensible, and just suggesting that employees could have maybe 4 days a month working from home. And then at that, you're sort of letting out a little bit, you can see, because you don't want everybody necessarily working from home. They can often end up working in a silo, and you do need that collaboration and that teamwork to be more effective, which it can be when you're all together in the office.
You make a moot point there about productivity as well. I mean, I'm sure that, well, I don't know, if after a long weekend, such as the one we've just had, is the best example. But when people come back from a weekend, they are quite often energised. They quite often got their mojo back with regards to what they want to do and their objectives, etc. They hit the floor running on that Sunday morning, Monday morning, and other parts of the world here. By the end of the week, that sort of waned, isn't it? You're starting to look at the clock. And, oh, hang on, we're 5 minutes away from lunch, then I've got a whole hour off, and then it's nearly the weekend, etc. It's that mentality that needs to change, I'm sure, in terms of embracing the opportunities of productivity, making the most of the time that you have at your desk or within the office environment.
Yes, and I think there's a lot that's been done in most industries now to move away from the highly repetitive nature of some tasks. And so jobs now can be much more inclusive, remits are extended, people are more multi-skilled, and that doesn't mean that everybody's necessarily doing the same thing day after day. And I think that's where the TUC data was coming from. When you're looking at this highly repetitive jobs, of course that's where artificial intelligence and robotics will actually overtake in terms of technology advances and replace human role in that purpose. But in terms of more creative jobs and more managerial jobs, you don't actually have such high voice of repetition.
Some really interesting comments coming through on this one. This one's from ME out there. It's not me, but it's ME. Thank you very much indeed for that. Those are the initials coming through saying, last year I was working a four-day week as a government technician for four months from the beginning of last year. It was awesome. Felt like a mini vacay each and every week. Thank you for that one. And one's also come through from NP. Thank you, NP, for this one, saying, I work Sunday through to Thursday, but I get off at midday on a Thursday instead of later on. It's beautiful. It does feel like a little vacation. Going back to full length Fridays will be tough for sure. It's just those small little changes, isn't it? And that I suppose that's what pays down the line as well, because we were talking off air about motivating one's staff and showing recognition and pat on the back where it's needed, but also constructive criticism where it's needed as well. At the same time, those little give backs mean the world to employees.
Indeed. And I think, you know, just as any relationship is built on trust, it's the same between the employer and the employee. And you need to be very clear in terms of what the expectations are in the role, the scope of the role, what their key performance indicators must be. If you set those out and give people annual appraisals, proper induction, proper training, all of that employee support, which is best practice for companies around the world today, and still lacking, I have to say, in some pockets you'll see evident even here in the UAE, but a different culture. But if you take the global culture of where best practice is coming for employee relations, then that does actually create that bond of trust between the employee and the employer.
Sarah's been in touch. Sony is the Netherlands a beautiful place to live, but its four-day work week is definitely a plus as well. The workforce averages around 29 hours a week with an average annual wage of about $47,000. Great. I'm sure that gives you extra time to enjoy the delights of the Netherlands, beautiful country. I suppose the difference here, and again, it's trying to work out one's market, is it's all good and well looking at a week from an hour's point of view and saying 29 hours a week average. That's something that I don't think would fly here at the moment because of just of the nature of work here.
I agree. And I think certainly in our industry in education, we don't have any such limit on ours.
I wish,
if we get a 24-hour working day, then that's probably quite normal, I think. But and certainly that's all your teachers would tell you as well. So I think it is does vary. But I know that, you know, even this long bank holiday weekend that we've had with the Thursday public holiday for the Islamic New Year, I received emails yesterday from government employees here from the regulator with critical information that was business critical for implementation this morning. So they're working. You know, it's not just the private sector who always feels if they're the ones that are doing the most. The public sector employees here, the government employees, take it very seriously indeed. And, you know, life is a vocation, work is a vocation for them to do the best they can in their role for government.
Let's go to the lines now and say good morning to Norsheen, who's currently in Ras Al Khaimah. Good morning to you, Norsheen.
Hi, good morning, Tom.
So have you experienced a four-day week in the past?
Yes, I have. At the organization I currently work at, for about 4 years in between, I had a four-day week. And we still maintain flexible working hours. But about a year and a half ago, I got put back on a five-day week.
And what was the experience, now that you've had the ability to sort of compare and contrast, which do you prefer?
Definitely the four-day week for whether it was something how I function personally or whether it was the nature of the work we do. But I've worked in, you know, five-day weeks before I joined the organization, then the four-day week, and now back to five. Mm. And what I found in myself was that I was much more productive during the four-day weeks because I kind of enjoyed the fact that I had work to go into. So I'd either go in early or stay late because I knew I had that extra day in the week where my son would be at school and I could manage to do anything else I needed to. So whether it was going to the bank, going to the doctor, you know, doing groceries, any extra work I had. Sometimes I'd even go into work on that day I had off because, you know, it was my day. I could do whatever I wanted with it. And then I had 2 days on the weekend to spend with my family. So I was very productive. However, now going back to a five-day week, I actually do find myself calling in sick days more often and, you know, booking appointments during the workday because I don't have that day anymore. So yeah. I feel like I'm a lot less productive.
Norsheen, so thanks so much indeed for sharing your thoughts with us this morning. Much appreciated. All the best to you for the rest of the day there. Norsheen giving her examples and thoughts of the four-day week. It's one thing I hadn't really thought about as well. We've got Ros Marshall with us in the studio. I'm just going to get her thoughts on this. That idea of you know, not just productivity in the workplace, but productivity for you personally as well. We all have bits and pieces to do, whether it be go to the doctor or get your blood test done, get to the dentist, go and sort something out at the bank. There's admin that we all need to do. And traditionally, you can't do all that admin over the weekends because the required offices are not open. So again, I suppose this four-day week would give you that ability, that time to be able to better manage your own time and not make it as many excuses as you need to your employees about being away from the office for those sort of things.
Well, yeah, I mean, I can identify with that and think in terms of when I took maternity leave way time ago now. But I also used to make sure you get the household chores done, you get everything sorted out. So you had the weekend as a family to enjoy together when everybody had 2 days off. But I think also here you must counter that with the fact that in the UAE and in Dubai, a lot of the places that you need to do all of your administrative work, your banking and other appointments and so on, there's a lot of them that are open in very, very convivial hours into the evenings. And that certainly isn't the case back home for a lot of us. So there's quite a lot of things I think that happen here already to help people be flexible in the hours that they need to attend some of these services. So it's all down to personal organisation really. But I think there was an interesting point where the lady was talking about between 4 and 5 days. And the lady from Lighthouse, who's actually the clinical psychologist there, Dr. Saliha Afrida, mentions in her article here that people actually, a lot of people here work 6 days a week and sometimes seven. But even just having one day off, it's not enough. It actually makes people resentful. And I thought that was an interesting comment, that people actually resent just having one day off. Mm. Probably some people resent just having 2 days off this weekend as well. But again, we were talking about how the country's matured and going back to the 80s and 90s, there was only ever 1.5 days off. And Thursday afternoon was your day off for the start of the weekend, and Friday, and then everyone was back in at work on Saturday.
So that's what it was. That was my working week when I first arrived here back in 2000. So exactly that, things have changed, and the very weekend has changed as well during that time. I've just got one more comment on this one, then we're going to move the conversation forward, but feel free to keep your thoughts coming in. This one's from Barry, who says, when you work 4 days a week, I can assure you that you find weekends much more relaxing than your weekday off. I'm sure I'm not alone in saying that the weekday you don't work increases guilt because everyone else is working. You can see emails coming in, stuff happening, and you assume that you're missing out and people are waiting on you for things. Right, we're going to dive into end of term gratuities in just a few moments' time. There's been a lot about this in the press recently. Are we getting to that point now where people are questioning the validity of the end-of-term payments?
I think it's options, really. The article I was reading over the weekend just surprised me with the fact of how many companies don't fully fund their gratuity. That was a real shock to me, because that's something certainly from my experience with Talim, we'd never... sound like John Lewis, never knowingly undersold. But we don't underfund that. It's a very important commitment to our staff. And I think that the ideas of, well, what was it for, people coming to the country, what is gratuity all about? First of all, your sort of quickest answer is, it's a bit like a pension plan, but you get it all back when you leave. That sort of idea for staff here, depending on the job and the employees' work here, it's how long they're going to stay here for. And therefore, the country now is looking at, are there other alternatives? Are there market-based private savings plans, and it's worth exploring.
Ross Marshall's with us here in studio. We're working through some of the stories that I'm sure you are discussing around water coolers and possibly during your mid-morning coffee break, wherever you are out there at the moment. We're talking about gratuity payments, and I'm sure that is a conversation that is always rife in offices. What about this question mark, though, that is hanging over the whole future of the gratuity payment system? Workplace reforms have swept across the UAE recently. I suppose, Roz, one of the things that's prompting this conversation is the fact that there was a tradition that people would be in a role for a couple of years maybe here and then move on, that transient nature of working here in the region. That's changing, and people are staying in their roles a lot longer now.
They are, and I think it's the gratuity works for people who are typically thinking about moving here and working for perhaps less than 5 years. But as you quite rightly say now, the number of people here for more than 5 years, which of course is where the maximum gratuity threshold clicks in on the limited contract, that's increasing all the time. So along with that increase is the liability then for companies to actually accrue the gratuity, because the worst thing that could happen, you'd have a substantial impact on your balance sheet if you didn't accrue for gratuity and you had a number of high leavers in any 1 year. And that sort of smacks of the pensions crisis that we've seen all over the Western world and Europe in particular, where defined benefit pensions plans are grossly underfunded. And I think something like the FTSE companies the FTSE 350, something like 70% of their profits would need to be diverted to resources away from other projects to ensure the long-term viability of their pension deficit. So I'm just actually filling the hole.
So as it stands, if you've done 5 years in a role, you've met the threshold then, have you?
You've met a different threshold.
Okay.
Where if you leave after 5 years, you have a full month of pay.
Yeah.
After your 5 years, the first 5 years, you get 3 weeks per year of service if you're on a fixed term contract. And if you're on an unlimited contract, it's actually less than that. And it changes at different times. But after 5 years, whatever your contract is, it is a month per year of service.
So in the interest of balancing the books for large companies and for smaller companies out there, I suppose the balance is ensuring that you've got enough in the kitty, in the bank, to fund those gratuity as and when.
Yes, I mean, from Talim's perspective, we actually provide annually for accruals for all of our staff every year. So we have a rolling tag of how long people have been with us. And if they were to leave, then what would that be? Because you're accruing that gratuity every year for eventually when they do leave. And that's important. You can't afford to get caught out. So I was quite surprised in this report that there's a startling number suggesting as many as 88% of companies across the GCC, not just UAE, have no plan in place to fund gratuities due. So the question that really raises is, is it still relevant? And what are the options for alternatives? You know, if you had something different that was a bit like a pension scheme and a market-based private savings plan, and how would that look? And would that be something, as you mentioned, that would attract or detract from employees coming in? Would they really want to tie themselves to that if they typically move around? You don't want to tie up your money in complex schemes. And, you know, you're always urged to start saving for your future as early as your 20s, which when you're thinking about working until 67 or so, that seems a heck of a long way away. But in starting early in how much you put away each month, is both a sort of key factor to how much you can then afford to retire and when.
And I suppose, again, this is demanding creativity at the moment with things changing, trends changing within the employee market at the moment. We've mentioned pensions there. We've mentioned the end of service gratuity. There's also been chat of saving plans, haven't there, that companies need to sort of embrace an idea and try and encourage their employees to get involved in saving plans within the company.
Yes, and that's sort of the compromise, really, because, I mean, the end of service benefit here that was never designed to be a retirement fund.
Right.
So we're to sort of opposite ends of the spectrum. But often most people will use that either to pay off debt when they leave or to fund an extra trip home or something more exciting on their one-way ticket back home when they leave. So it can either be seen for those who are financially literate as being an opportunity just to have some extra savings at the end. But it's not aligned to anything index linked. It's not actually tied into anything that's going to accumulate for your pension pot, which it might do if you were living and working in your own home country and in a pension scheme. So the end of service retirement gratuity here is not a retirement pension. It's just a lump sum accrued of how much you've actually accrued in your length of service.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.